Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
I'm Carrie Miller, and this is the Friday Roundtable. And of course, we're reflecting on what it means to be in a world without Prince. Today, we've invited three guests to share their experiences and their perceptions and their memories of Prince. But I want to hear from you, too, on this. In the year since Prince has died, is there a particular song or an album that you've been drawn to? Perhaps you find yourself listening to it differently. You can share that with me on Twitter, at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R. Our guest today, Harriet Cole, is the founder of Dream Leapers and knew, wrote about, and eventually worked for Prince for his Welcome to America tour. And she's with us from New York. And Harriet, welcome. Good to have you on the show.
Very happy to be here. Thank you.
Toki Wright is with us. He's an Emmy Award-winning musician and runs the multimedia company Soul Tools Entertainment. Welcome back. Good to have you here.
Thank you for having me back.
And Ann Powers is a longtime music critic and the music critic and correspondent for NPR. And she's with us today from Nashville. And Ann, welcome to you. Good to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me.
So, Ann, the occasion gave me a chance to go back and read that piece that you wrote about your experience with Prince. It was on the eve of New Year's Eve in 2008, and Prince previewed an album with you, and you reflected on how music and faith and personal history came together to create such powerful sounds. So do you remember the experience?
Well, of course, I'll never forget it. Prince has been, you know, one of my idols since I was a young person. And to meet him was a thrill, but to meet him was also completely surreal. And I'm sure that Harriet will have some things to say about this. Prince lived in a world of his own construction, a world of pure imagination. and I entered that world only for a night. I went to his house. I was working for the Los Angeles Times at the time, and he was living in L.A. He had moved to L.A. in order to learn more about the music industry so he could more effectively release his own albums. And actually, he released three albums in connection with Target that year, and we were listening to all three. But it was pretty amazing. I went to this mansion he was living in Beverly Hills, and for every album, he would take me to a different room, basically, or we would have a different listening experience for every album he wanted to play. So the first one, he brought me into the car that he had purchased from Miles Davis. We listened in the car. The second one, which was actually by one of his many female proteges, this was Bria Valente, we listened to in his bedroom. You can imagine that was quite unnerving.
Wow.
In a wonderful way.
Yeah.
He did have a circular bed, but I just sat near the wall and like was very nervous as he danced around to the record. And then the third one we listened to in the limo as he and I and Bria drove to a nightclub in Hollywood, where he proceeded to jump on stage with the bands. The whole thing was really just the fantasy that any fan would want fulfilled of being hanging out with Prince, and I'm sure he completely staged it, but in a strange way it felt very natural and he was very comfortable. So I think that really reveals a lot about Prince. He was comfortable in these highly structured, creative, almost imaginary worlds he made, and he welcomed all of us into them, and that's the wonder of his music.
So, Anne, was the song that he played in the bedroom that night Elixir?
Sorry, what? I don't remember.
I think it was.
I do not remember anything about what songs he played because I was so confused and trying to just keep it together.
Here it is. Here's Elixir.
Place in
had never heard that song before. I love it. Toki, what do
it's
you hear in
song.
It? It is.
It sounds beautiful. No, it sounds like the beautiful side of Prince that that you know matches with the grit.
Prince was known for working with many, many women artists throughout his career, some of whom we know very well, like Sheila Escovedo, Sheila E., Wendy and Lisa, some who were famous before they connected with Prince, like Chaka Khan, for example, and then others who maybe never really grabbed the spotlight, but no matter what he touched musically, this has been one of the, I don't want to say positive things, there's nothing positive about his death, but one of the beautiful things about his legacy is that people are now exploring his whole catalog,
definitely,
including these projects that had been sort of ignored when they came out, and we have a whole other world of Prince music, because he basically composed all of this music, that adds to the world we already had, and that's a beautiful thing.
Let's listen to a little more of Elixir.
Yes, it does. Hand in hand.
And Harriet, that's really the thing that I want the roundtable to be about, which is what we know and understand about Prince in his absence. The fact that we're motivated to go back and explore the music maybe more deeply. What would you say about that?
Oh, it's, you know, he was so prolific. I think that's the thing. Being as prolific as he was, it was hard for people to catch up. And so now we have an opportunity to catch up. Like many other artists, he had those mega hits that everybody knows. And even in his concerts, he kind of had to perform some of the big, big hits. But he would add in others and kind of train the audience to listen more broadly. Because he was constantly making music. When I went to Paisley Park once, it was when I was running Ebony Magazine, and this was in 2010. And we had convinced Prince through Tavis Smiley for us to do a cover story on him. And trust me, this took months, and it was to convince Prince to do anything, and he actually does it. Okay. So, you know, we were already in Minnesota, not sure that he was going to let us come to the house. It was so crazy. But we get there. Tavis was supposed to write the story about him because they're close friends. He and I started talking. I'm producing the image. That's what I was supposed to be doing, producing the cover. Mm-hmm. And we got to talking, and within a couple of minutes, we were talking about God and life and the cosmos, because he loves to talk about those things. And he then decided that I was going to write the story. And, of course, without a tape recorder, because he never allowed anybody to tape anything. And I'm like, Prince, we're in a recording studio. You can record it and give me the transcript. No.
So you had that experience too.
Of course you did. You're going to
have
to scrabble it down. And the thing is, he was so, I mean, dare I say, paranoid about being represented as he was. And the way he was so different, so enigmatic. So, you know, he liked to be like the Sphinx. And so you have these puzzle ways of how he's speaking, and you're trying to scribble that down and get it accurate, which was just crazy. But all in the midst of this, because we just connected. After we do the shoot, he invites us to stay for dinner. He had Shelby J and Cassandra were downstairs making some music. I hadn't even met them yet. He took us downstairs. They had just put to track something he had just written. And he said, listen to this. And then he got up on the stage in his soundstage and gave us a mini performance. And we were there forever.
Wow.
I mean, and so this instant of making music in the midst of, he took me into his library where he has all of his spiritual books, because he wanted it to be clear that his foundation was like a direct line to God.
Yeah, I think that really speaks to a lot of the presentation that Prince has had over the years. Looking at Xenophobia was an event that happened out at Paisley Park. It was like a 7-day festival where all these different artists came from across the world to perform, and people were invited into the space. And there's like places you can go, places you can't go. Certain times you can be there, certain times you can't do things. And that kind of mystery, one, speaks to being private and protected, but it does kind of build like this figure, you know, in your mind where there's someone bigger than just a musician and bigger than just the artist. And his direct connection with community and being there and being connected to a lot of activity in town, making sure that things happen beneath the surface, like things that you can talk about or that you can't really talk about with anybody, you know, the privacy, it was always fascinating and always mysterious. Yeah, I remember being at maybe Bunkers, and there was a show, and I was with a hip-hop group back then, and we were told that we weren't supposed to be in a certain area, and then at the last second we were told, okay, now you're doing security. And like, okay, so our job was to stand in front of Prince while he walked in and then stand in front of his booth while he watched the show. Oh, and so we're standing in front of his booth for about 15 minutes, and then next thing you know, you see Prince walk on stage, and we're still standing in the back, and it was just that whole mysteriousness of him.
Yeah, and I noticed in listening to the three of you that you've all alluded or said directly that the sense of mystery was really important to him. And again, as you say, we lost him too soon, but you know, his death at this point was so much more music to make, and as enigmatic as he was, you know, in so many ways, the mystery kind of continues.
Well, there are a million stories. There's so many stories that are coming forth. You know, in part, he didn't want any stories to be told. And now people, even now, you know, somewhat guardedly, you know, what's an appropriate story to tell because you want to honor his memory? But because there are so many people with stories,
right,
there are layers of the mystery that, you know, continue to be peeled back. I wanted to share something similar to Toki. So I worked on the Welcome to America tour. I had left Ebony and reopened my business. And he contacted me, will you come and cover all the opening acts and write about them? I'm like, sure. Mm-hmm. Anyhow, early on, he did this. The opening event was in New Jersey. And what he typically would do would be to give out tons of money to charities, but never telling anybody. This time he decided to call a press conference. The press guardedly came because they didn't think he would allow an interview. He was supposed to stand up and give money to Harlem Children's Zone, to Misty Copeland, who was dancing with him at the time for American Ballet Theater and for Uptown Ballet Theater. At the last second, he says to me, Harriet, I'm not going to do it. You're going to do it. You're going to be my spokesperson. I'm like, are you kidding me? And I, by the way, had just broken my foot. I'm on crutches. I had to go up underneath, you know, where he would come out from the stage, from the ground. I had to go up underneath of that thing. Prince was 5'2". I'm 5'9 and a half. And I had crutches. I had to climb up this podium and then tell them, Prince is not going to do this. I'm going to give out this, you know, $1.5 million. Mm-hmm. And they booed me.
Jeez.
And when all the gifts were given and they were really angry, he comes out and starts shaking hands with Jeffrey Canada and Misty Copeland and ignores them. That was
Anne, you were gonna say also about kind of this sense of enigma and mystery. What were you gonna add?
Maybe we can talk about the mystery of Prince in a bit. But as far as the way he controlled his public image, I think one thing that's been discussed a lot since Prince left us is how aware he was of the challenges he faced as a fully independent, visionary, genius African-American musician in an industry and in a country that has constantly limited the possibilities for people of color, even as the music itself is founded on, you know, African-American creativity, right? So this was something that Prince was deeply aware of, I think. And part of, I think in retrospect, we can see that much of this intense need to control every situation he was in had to do with his desire and his determination to maintain control, dignity, freedom, liberty within his creative life, within his professional life, in all aspects of his life. And so, you know, when he would promise to come greet a crowd, but then hang back and maybe greet them in an hour or something. I mean, we've all seen performances where sometimes I have to admit it, like, made me unhappy if it was like 4 hours late going on. but it was part of this masterful insistence on, I control my world and I invite you into my world. I am generous beyond fault mm-hmm. within my world, but I control my world. And, you know, we also lost Chuck Berry recently, and I've been thinking a lot about how Prince and Chuck Berry share so much in common. One thing that they share is they're both extremely just exceptional artists who, because they are African-American men, faced certain struggles and barriers and were judged in ways that their white peers were not. And they both tried to set up kind of their own realms. I mean, Chuck Berry had Berry Park in St. Louis, yeah. which never became the successful entertainment complex he wished, but was a place he lived for all of his life and worked. And I think, you know, Paisley Park was a continuation of the work that Chuck Berry did. And throughout the history of rock and roll and funk and soul, we see these figures who are making worlds that are better than the world we live in. And we can enter into them when we're listening to their music. But, you know, it's all in relationship to the realities of our culture, which are not always beautiful.
Toki?
And I'd say that I always look at Prince similarly. I look at his relationship with being a black man in Minnesota. Like, those three things were always being responded to, whether consciously, subconsciously. Just like the relationship with punk, funk, and disco, like coming out of punk, which was heavily white, funk, which is heavily black, and disco, which is this integrated space, not only just with race, different races of people, different nationalities, ideologies, sexual preferences, you know, people getting into the same, into similar spaces that weren't getting into spaces before and being recognized in spaces. And so his representation as a black male from Minnesota, you know, being black is already, we're defining person, place, and thing, you know, not necessarily in that order. Mm-hmm. You know, what does it mean to be black in America when we may not always be regarded as the standard? What does it mean to be a male, and what are the definitions behind your masculinity and how you present yourself? And what does it mean to be a Minnesotan, where black Minnesotans aren't necessarily at the front of the conversation all the time? And if you even think into history, you know, what black Minnesotan figure could you think of being spoken on in the national arena or national spotlight before 1985? You didn't hear about anybody else, you know. And so how do we how are we defining a generation of people? How are we defining a new generation of people? How do we represent ourselves? How do we become our creative selves and define ourselves differently?
Harriet, would you say something about that?
What this has me thinking about is confidence. And so I'm going a little bit to another angle, but it is this. When I spent a lot of time with Prince behind the scenes, mm-hmm. and I watched how he saw people, and he would consistently notice the greatness in people and call it forth. And I heard him say on so many occasions to people, do you realize how great you are? Which is not necessarily the thing that you hear people say so regularly. He championed the greatness within others. And so, you know, to the point of him being a black man in Minnesota, this is something as he looked at others, he was looking for that greatness and helping them to step up. An example, when Misty Copeland danced with him, you know, I mean, the most incredible thing that I saw her do was to jump up on the baby grand piano on point. But
gosh, wow.
It was just outstanding. But what he saw in her, the superstar that she is now, this was in 2010. And he said to me, Harriet, I want you to get her on the cover of Essence magazine. I want you to get her on the cover of. He gave me a list. Now. Like, I want you to do it now. And I said, well, Prince, people don't know her yet. We need a strategy. Do it now. And so actually he put us together so I could be of support to her. And she had a great support system already. But one of the things that he did was to go with her to American Ballet Theater and pitch an opera that he was creating for her to dance to. Now, it didn't happen with them, mm-hmm. but the fact that he went to the leadership of American Ballet Theater and said, look, this girl is a superstar. She should be a principal now. I want her to dance in my opera. He saw, like, he fast-forwarded way into the future and demanded it now for others, not just for himself. And he often would champion who we might call the underdog, and that may be the wrong term, but for example, everyone was courting him to be on their show. Jimmy Fallon came, they all came. And he thought, Jimmy, I talked to him, he thought that it was a shoo-in, he was going to be on the Tonight Show, and Prince chose George Lopez. Because, you know, he's a brother. He had the show that was probably the least popular. He could use a boost. And he connected so completely with him. Everybody else was so angry. And the ratings went through the roof. And George Lopez's people worked with us. You know, the whole entourage came. And it was like the anointing. But it was an anointing of George Lopez. So even as Prince has this mystique of just being the one and a one that stands out far from anyone else, very consistently he would, I mean, I had many conversations with him about, do you realize how great you are, Harriet? You can do anything. And especially when people may have a moment where they're feeling down, he would find a way to lift them up.
And I think that we as fans and listeners have benefited so much from his generosity because, as a mentor to everyone from, you know, Sheena Easton to Sheila E. to Janelle Monáe to, you know, just bringing Larry Graham back, you know, from who is such a great bass player and, you know, working with him. The list goes on and on, working with the bands he worked with, The Time, The Family, his last band, Third Eye Girl, all of these great musicians and a really underrated singer, I think, that he was working with toward the end of his life, Judith Hill. We benefit from him putting these people in the spotlight. And it again, as Harriet, I think, mentioned, he was just endlessly productive and worked under so many different configurations, whether it was under his own name or through these other artists. And just the mind boggles at how much music remains to be listened to. And that comes from his generosity of spirit.
You're listening to the Friday Roundtable. We've invited three guests who have some insight, experience, have spent time with Prince in the year since Prince has died. We're talking about what it means to be in the world without Prince creating new music. Luckily, there's a long musical legacy for us to consider. Toki Wright is with us. He's an Emmy Award-winning musician. He runs the multimedia company Soul Tools Entertainment. He's with me in the studio here. Harriet Cole is the founder of Dream Leapers, new wrote about and eventually worked for Prince for one of his tours. And Ann Powers is with us. She's the music critic and correspondent for NPR, joining us from Nashville. Hey, I think we need to play a little more music here. We're doing a lot of talking, and I think we should listen to some of this music together. Why don't we play Little Red Corvette? And then I'm going to share with you something that the music writer Greil Marcus said about this song a year ago when we were, you know, in those early hours and days of Prince's death. Here it is.
Sideways, I don't wouldn't last. See, you're a kind of person who believes in making out once, love them and leave them fast. Guess I must be dumb. She had a pocket full of horses, children, and some of them used. But it was Saturday night. I guess that makes it all right. You see, what have I got to lose? And honey, I say, little red Corvette, baby, you're much too fast. Ooh, little red Corvette, you need a love that's gonna last.
Harriet, I was thinking when you were talking about the confidence that he had a very confident sexuality in the beginning. Was there something unusual about that? How did you see that in the time that you spent with him?
Well, I want to go backwards. The very first time I went to a Prince concert, I was in college, and it was a first date with a guy. Neither of us had heard his music, so we dressed up to go like you're going to church. And we go there, and he's singing. You know, he has sex with his guitar on stage. I'm like, oh, my God, I can't look at this man. I'm, you know? So that was my introduction to Prince.
Yeah.
And so fast forward, you know, this little guy with the light up Lucite heels, mm-hmm. who's, you know, big as a minute, as my mother would say. He was so sexy. Like, just seeing him from afar and the smell of him. He always had on some kind of oil. You know, his makeup was better than any woman who was there. You know, and he was just, there was a sexuality about him that was extremely masculine, even as, you know, he dressed in what we generally call women's clothes.
I know.
Even casually. But the sexuality was kind of this old school thing. He had no need to show it in public. It was part of the mystery, the dance, the eye contact. And I observed all of it, and it was just lovely to see that a man would court a woman in a way that was respectful.
You have to hear the not only the sexiness, but in the vocal presentation, but the sexiness in the music, and how the song is called Little Red Corvette, and you go through and listen to it. It has some of the percussion is very, you know, that electronic sound, but it's still swinging. It's not it's not quantized. It's not just stuck on a grid. It's kind of swinging, and you hear this live guitar being played over it. But then there's synths, and so there's like these this. The instruments are ultimately having sex with each other in the song.
There you go.
So I will never listen to this song the same. And thank you for that, Toki. Thank you very much. And I want you to listen to something that Greil Marcus said a year ago about this song. He kind of surprised me with this. Let's hear it.
Along with the Rolling Stones' Going Home, it's just the sexiest piece of music ever recorded. I think if you took the vocal off, no words, it still would be. It is just the the bending and the turning and the stretching and the reaching in those chords, whether it's the guitar, whether it's the organ, it doesn't matter. It is just all movement, and it's all slow, and nothing is going to be rushed.
Anne, what do you think?
Well, absolutely. You know, there's a great essay on the song When Doves Cry. I'm sorry, I forget the author, where it talks about how the structure of that song mirrors the female sexual release, female orgasm. Mm-hmm. And that song, of course, famously didn't have a bass line. It uses other instruments to create the effect of a bottom that's different than the usual bottom in a pop song or a rock song. And Prince was constantly innovating musically as a way of getting at the rhythms of the body, the rhythms of joy, of sexuality. The writer Touré, who published a good book about Prince called I Would Die For You, talks about how In Prince's songs, he may have been inspired by pornography. He actually famously once said in an interview that he learned everything that went into his music from looking at his mother's porn collection, which probably was a myth, but an interesting one when you think about it. And the reason is because his songs, like Little Red Corvette, often take scenarios that seem pretty standard issue porn, but they turn them around. And the most significant thing they do, which they do both in the music by playing around with arrangements and, as Greil is saying, you know, bending and moving those instrumentations, but also by changing the perspective. In his sexually explicit scenarios, it's the women who are in charge. You know, in Little Red Corvette, in Darling Nikki, in Raspberry Beret, and it's just endless. All of those songs, the women are the ones who are making the decisions, and he is the delighted kind of beta male in those situations. I love that. It really is a challenge to the conventional ways we think about sexuality in music or in popular culture in general. And I think that's a major gift that Prince gave us.
You're listening to the Friday Roundtable. It's a roundtable considering music and the life of Prince and what it is to be in a world without Prince now a year since he died. Ann Powers, Toki Wright, Harriet Cole with us. We're going to get a look at the latest news, and then we'll continue our conversation.
Good morning, Carrie. I'm Phil Picardi in the NPR newsroom. President Trump is taking the unusual step of weighing in on France's upcoming presidential election, predicting the latest attack in Paris will have a big effect on voters there. His tweet comes as he tries to bolster support for hardline proposals on immigration and foreign policy, including demands that Congress fund a bigger U.S. border wall with Mexico. Trump today tweeted, "The people of France will not take much more of this. Will have a big effect on presidential election." Far-right French candidate Marine Le Pen is making her second bid for the French presidency. The terror attack that killed a police officer on the Champs-Élysées 3 days before the election fed into Le Pen's central campaign themes. Italy's president has condemned what he called a cowardly attack on police in Paris. President Sergio Mattarella says Italy not only takes France's side in the fight against extremist violence, but also is adhering to principles of freedom realized at the election time. U.S. Defense Secretary Jim Mattis says Syria still possesses banned chemical weapons. At a news conference in Tel Aviv, Mattis also said in recent days the Syrian Air Force has dispersed its combat aircraft. Mattis met today with Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. The state of Arkansas has carried out its first execution in nearly 12 years, despite a flurry of legal challenges that spared three other convicted killers. Liddell Lee was pronounced dead at 11:56 last night. The state wants to conduct three more executions before the end of April, when its supply of one lethal injection drug expires, but courts could still scuttle Arkansas's plan. Sunny skies expected across the state this afternoon. High temperatures ranging from the mid-50s northeast to the low 60s in the south. Right now, sunshine, 48 degrees in the Twin Cities. More news ahead on NPR News. The time now is 9:39.
Programming supported by The Guthrie, now playing Toni Morrison's The Bluest Eye. From the writer of Beloved and Song of Solomon comes a 1940s coming-of-age story. 5 weeks only, runs through May 21st. Tickets at GuthrieTheater.org.
I'm Carrie Miller, and you're listening to the Friday Roundtable. We're talking about Prince with Toki Wright, Harriet Cole, and Ann Powers. And I wanted to spend a little time talking about the influences that shaped him and the musicians that he shaped. And Harriet, I was reading something that Claire Evans, the lead singer of the band Yacht, wrote in this piece for Wired last year on how wide-ranging Prince's influence has been and how musicians really ought to just not be embarrassed at all to steal from him and tell everybody that they are stealing from him because, you know, it's an honor. So she said, his expressive falsetto resonates in the throats of Pharrell Williams, D'Angelo, or Justin Timberlake. His potent combination of churchy keyboards and frank sexuality caused a cultural meltdown that inspired Madonna's Sex on a Cross theatrics and Tipper Gore's parental advisory stickers in equal measure. He was proud of that?
Oh, I'm sure he was. He delighted in making people uncomfortable and in making them stretch. And, you know, so speak of Madonna. So back at the time that it was Madonna, it was Prince, and it was Michael Jackson. You know, they kind of became the mega superstars at the same time, and there was competition among them. You know, I think that he may not have talked about it in that way, but they were all striving to be the one at the same time. And he was different from either Michael or Madonna because he played every instrument. You know, he played the instruments, wrote the music, performed, did the staging. I mean, he was able to do what they did times 10 in his own way. And so, of course, that would influence others. And he loved to influence others. He also loved to bring them up. You know, as mentioned, some of the people of late, Esperanza Spalding, he had on a stage way before she won a Grammy. Yeah. Janelle Monáe in the same way. And he had them around and they were jamming together and figuring out music together. King is a group that's out now. He brought them into his space and helped to cultivate
from
them.
Minneapolis.
I mean, the list. Yeah, yeah. The list goes on and on and on. But during that time that I was interviewing all of the opening acts, it went from Maceo Parker, you know, from James Brown, you know, to Cassandra Wilson and Mary J. Blige and some unknowns. He brought the Foo Fighters were there one day. He brought everybody into the fold because he wanted to learn from people. He wanted to get in the studio and make music with them, but also he spent a lot of time talking to people. And I would say he would probably have said that the influences went back and forth. You know, he was not just giving or just receiving. There was this endless flow of energy and content, often very cerebral. When he put it to music, I think that kind of captured it.
I really think that He is extremely creative, and most extremely creative people are extremely spiritual in some sense. And I think of how revolutionary he was to music, specifically in the early late 80s, early 90s. Like, I would say the way that he revolutionized the way that you approach putting music out, the way that you approach presenting yourself on stage, the way you approach playing your music, the people that you bring around you, whether you have a tight unit or you are made up by a music by a record company. He was revolutionary in that sense, the same way that I would say like LSD was revolutionary to music in the late 60s. Uh-huh. You know, it totally changed the way that people thought about themselves and the way that they thought about approaching their everyday walk. And that, you know, that revolutionized the entire country, the entire world, I would say.
And I would add that Prince was part of a legacy, part of a history, an open secret history within rock and roll. So, you know, you do have this tension in rock and roll between African-American originators and white appropriators. And there's a dialogue among the races within rock and roll. But you can look from Chuck Berry to Jimi Hendrix to Prince to today someone like a Frank Ocean or, you know, even a Kanye West who is breaking the boundaries of the genre to which they are assigned and challenging the idea that, you know, an artist has to live within one category. I mean, Janelle Monáe, who was a mentee of his, is a great example of that, too. And you know, Prince also mentored musicians like Sinead O'Connor, who, of course, had her biggest hit with a cover of one of his songs, Nothing Compares to You, or the Bangles, the all-woman band who for whom he wrote Manic Monday. And he just never would accept any limit on the definition of what he did. And I think that that is a line that runs through popular music that's very distinct. People who constantly challenged the impulse the industry has to put you in a box, and it allowed for another story within rock and roll that, for someone like me, a fan like me, opened up so much in terms of what I thought I could listen to as you know, a white woman raised in Seattle, Washington, what I belonged to, what belonged to me, how I could connect. Prince was an artist who opened up doors for every kind of listener, and I'm sure that everyone in this conversation would agree that there is nothing more utopian than the audience at a Prince show. You know, that audience is just, it's just love, and it's people of all different sizes, shapes, ages, shades of you know, sexual orientation, whatever, sharing a space and sharing joy and beauty. And Prince shows really taught me the power of music to paint a better world.
Toki, on the utopia of the audience. Oh, I'm sorry, Harriet, go ahead, and then Toki.
Yeah, I just wanted to add another thing that he did that was so revolutionary, starting with when he had to change his name in order to get out of his contract. You know, he was creative when there was an obstacle, and then went on to make all of this music on his own, challenging all the while some of the ways in which music is presented now. Like, he was in an all-out war with even the notion of iTunes, because he was convinced that there was money not coming to the artist. Like Anne was saying, you know, this war between black artists and the industry sometime. But he thought it was true for everyone and maintained this to the end. Another thing that he did was to fight with these big promoters. So, for example, when he did Welcome to America, he decided in L.A. every night, he was doing 21 nights, and they were going to be $25 seats, because he saw how promoters would sell these tickets off and they'd be thousands of dollars, and who would get to come. He wanted the people to come. He got into such a big war with them that he fired the promoter. And then but there are all these concerts happening, and he had us produce some of these. Seriously, all the people who were there were left. Like, I have another job for you. Can you do this? Can you do that? And, of course, it didn't last very long. But he was willing to fight to the death for fairness in ticket price, for fairness in getting your money if you made the music. And he broke open those doors, which now, you know, everybody's talking about it. They thank him.
Yeah, he was constantly fighting corporate consolidation, you could tell. You know, seeing that the way that he approached music, especially around 1996 when the Telecommunications Act came out. And just being able to present yourself, present your own music, present your own show in your own image, in your own light, and not having to go through all these middle people, and being direct to consumer, direct to fan, direct to, you know, Prince family, New Power Generation, the website, that was revolutionary in itself, just being able to buy music directly from the artist, and how SoundCloud is so big and Bandcamp is so big today. Like, without people like Prince, without Prince specifically, to even think that I could just give my music directly to the people that want to hear it and not have to go through radio stations, not have to go through the television. You know, that's where we are now when you think about most music.
I know. Do you remember how weird it was, it felt, when he started to sell things online? I remember just trying to explain it in articles I would write. You know, it was almost unique what he was doing, and it was so far ahead of its time. It truly was. And what's interesting is that his fierce determination to hang on to his music, both, you know, financially and also just the creative, not the control in making it, but the control in how people could access it. It did affect how his legacy was operating before he passed. I think it was difficult to find Prince music online, and you could see him live. He was touring relentlessly, which I think really tragically contributed probably to the chronic pain he suffered, which led to his death. I mean, he gave himself to us. It's mind-boggling. But it was difficult to find his music online. Since he's passed, it's much more available. It's been kind of a free-for-all. And we've seen this rejuvenation of his legacy and people going beyond the classics and discovering how much great music he made in the 90s and the 2000s and all the way up to the end of his life. And it's ironic because, you know, it was so important what he was doing to control his legacy, but it also made it so that people didn't fully understand his legacy until he passed. And one thing we have now, and again, I sort of said this in the beginning, it's not... nothing makes up for the fact he's gone, but we do have these vaults that are opening, and we are realizing the breadth of what he gave us, and that is a beautiful thing. It's our comfort in this time.
You know, Harriet and Toki, I was thinking about that what is the music that Prince will never make? Mm-hmm. And in some ways, that's not the right question, because as Anne says, there's so much music that he might never have shared with us. But as Anne says, the vaults are being opened. And now what? How do you feel about that, Toki? Do you?
I say leave his music
alone. Do you? Okay. You're uncomfortable with that.
Yeah. I think of all of the Tupac Machiavelli albums that came out after he died. There's like 6 or 7, and they're all music that he may not have intended mm-hmm. to put out. You know, if I try to draw a picture and it doesn't come out right, I might put it away.
Yeah.
If I make a song and it's not ready for the public, I put it away. All those songs weren't ready. So why are we choosing something that he didn't choose? So I'd say leave sacred sacred.
I was actually talking about the stuff that was released that had become really difficult to access. So I hear you on the unreleased material, but I just mean the material that had been released that not everyone, you know, had just in their CD collections.
For sure, for sure, for sure.
That I think it's great that people can hear.
And I would just add, I think I am a bridge between these concepts. I think that there should be no rush to releasing anything that's in the vault. I think it's way too soon. He's only gone a year. It's, you know, it's still a fresh wound in a sense. But if the right producers go in and listen, I believe that there are gems to be harvested, but it needs to be done in such a careful way that it's probably years from now. In the same way that some of the greatest artists, you know, whatever their art is, there are things that are unearthed over time, whether it's writing, whether it is drawing, sculpture, what it might be. There may be something for us, but we need to be patient.
You know, Toki was kind of wincing when you were saying that, Harriet.
Oh.
And I really understand this because, you know, I'm deep into books and love literature. Just now, F. Scott Fitzgerald's stories that were never published have now been collected in a new short stories in a new collection. And I just feel queasy about the idea that I'm reading something that I don't know he thought was ready. I mean, he was sending them off because he was broke. But were they really ready to be seen?
And you know, to the point of finding the right producers, and this is definitely not to be argumentative, but finding the right producers, like he was the best producer. Like, and if he needed anybody, he could get them. And so, you know.
You know
it.
What? I could argue myself out of the point, by the way, in that he was a genius. I mean, he was a genius in ways that have not been replicated. You know, there's certain, you know, you can pick off different aspects of him, as you were saying, the influences, but there was so much to him. And I would agree that there is no one like him. There is a curiosity in me about what exists. You know, one of the things we didn't talk about in terms of his live performances, he would stay up all night. After the show, there was always a party. Globally, people would know, would find out what the party is. The amount of energy that he had staying up and performing, jumping on the piano, or bringing somebody else up, playing music that you never heard before, or, you know, improvising, creating something in the moment. The mastery of being in the moment is something that just he was always able to be present.
And that's part of the mystery of a religious experience. Like, you can read the book or you can go to church. There's two different feelings. You know?
It felt like going to church with him.
We can learn so much more from a tossed-off guitar solo that Prince did than from most artists' entire catalogs. So, I mean, I think it challenges us in a sense to be to think differently about music, and maybe those of us who write about music to create a new form of criticism that talks about the presence that you guys, that you, Toki and Harriet, are talking about. How do we critique that presence or write about that presence, which is different, you know, than any other artist gave us? I would say someone like Jimi Hendrix, I think, had periods of his career where he was doing something similar. I remember reading another guitarist writing about Hendrix and how he played the whole stage, you know, the whole concept of the way he used feedback. It changed the instrument, so it challenged the way that people could receive it, right? It's a whole different game when someone like Hendrix or Prince walks in the room. And so maybe what we'll see from people assessing and appreciating Prince's legacy is a whole new way of thinking about music through what he left for us.
We have the chance to close the roundtable with a Prince song. I have to ask the three of you to somehow agree on what that song ought to be. What do you think?
Agree?
Well, you got another? Yeah, you have like a few more hours.
See, I'm mid-90s, New Jack Swing era, you know.
So what is it, Toki?
I mean, you know, Diamonds and Pearls.
I love that. That's my favorite. I love that album so much.
That was, look how easy that was. Harriet, can you get
cool
in on
that?
Okay, so my favorite is actually one that he didn't even write.
Oh.
What if God was one of us?
Ooh. Oh, yeah.
What if God was one of us? I mean, I love so much of his music, but that is him. Like, that sense of walking with all of us as God. That is how I saw him. That is what he showed me. And it rings through every song to me.
Thank you, all three of you, for the time and the insight and your experience. Boy, most of all, your experiences with Prince. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
God had a name. What would it be? And would we call it to his face? If we were faced with him and all his glory, what would you ask if you had just one question?
Operating support is provided by the McKnight Foundation. The McKnight Foundation supports the people, places, and possibilities that help the state and the world create a more vibrant future for everyone. Online at McKnight.org. Philanthropy in action.